Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 12th, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, what happens when you put a kilogram or more than 2 pounds of hops into a 20-liter or 5-gallon batch of beer? Then what happens when you analyze that beer for IBUs? Homebrewer Kim Udlin shares his hop-bursting monster beer, and Brad Sturgeon from Monmouth College takes it to his lab. If you're new to homebrewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And our 2012 Brewer's Logbooks are in stock. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us first and click on our associate link. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app, too. We've got information or news for our international listeners, those outside the United States. Apparently, we had a glitch with our online store at basicbrewingshop.com that some people that wanted to charge you a lot of shipping there. It wouldn't allow you to do anything but priority mail international. Well, we've apparently fixed that. So if you have been putting off buying something from basicbrewingshop.com because you didn't want to pay extremely high international shipping rates, give us another try, and you should see first-class international rates on there now. And if you don't, please let me know. Good news and bad news coming from Mississippi this week. Philip McNaniel writes, SB 2878 was signed into law last Thursday, and it was announced on Monday. SB 2878 raised the legal allowable ABW from 5% to 8% at beers sold in the state. Sadly, Philip says, the homebrew legalization bills and several other reforms needed to be made to the state's arcane laws failed to make it out of committee. The craft beer drinkers of Mississippi are celebrating, and there is next year for making progress on the homebrewing front. Well, thanks, Philip. Congratulations on the raising of the alcohol limit on commercial beers, and better luck next time with the homebrew legalization efforts. It's only a matter of time. The more that you educate your legislators, the better chance that they'll see the light and do the right thing. Keep up the fight, and thanks for keeping us posted. I've taken the next step in my batch for the Basic Brewing Radio Brew Your Own Magazine collaborative experiment on secondary fermentation. And that next step is I transferred one of my 2 fermenters to secondary, and I'm tracking the results there. No spoilers. I hope you're taking part 2. I believe the deadline for that is May 21st, so plenty of time to get involved. I'm really excited about this week's show, so let's get right into it. Kim Udlin sent 4 bottles of his super hoppy beer to me, and I sent 2 of those to Brad Sturgeon for analysis in his lab. So what do you get when you put 900 grams of hops into the last 5 minutes of a 20-liter boil and then dry hop with an additional 100 grams? Well, you get a bunch of confused Americans. But other than that, you get a pretty cool beer and an awesome experiment. Have a listen. Well, Brad Sturgeon, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks, James. It's great to be here.
And all the way from Norway, we have a first-timer, Kim Udlin. Welcome.
Thanks, James.
And say your name properly so that we know the proper way.
Kim Udlin.
There you go. It would take me lots more practice to get it right, so I appreciate your patience. But Kim, you're the inspiration of this show. You sent us a wild and crazy beer that we tasted here in Arkansas and then sent up to Brad at Monmouth College to do some testing. So we will get to that, but I want to put you kind of on hold for a second and then get some background from Brad, because we've had a history of doing some IBU testing. Maybe, Brad, if you could bring us up to speed on our meeting in June at the National Homebrewers Conference and the experiment that we tasted there and that you revealed to us at that point.
All right. Well, let me also say, James, that I appreciate you clearly stating testing from tasting. It's a tricky subject to be talking about both of them. But I think it's pretty clear that I'm going to be speaking on the half of the testing, although I did taste, but I think I'm going to leave that up to you guys to talk more about. We had had some conversations about trying to max out the IBUs in a beer, and I think it was your August 11th show where you played our interview that we did at the Homebrewers Conference in San Diego, where what we did back here in Monmouth in the lab is I made 1 gallon batches of beer, and I tried to load them up with hops. And unfortunately, from those results, no matter how much I put in there, I couldn't get much over 50 IBUs when we're just doing a single 60-minute hop addition. We did a follow-up on that on the 25th of August, where we talked about I reanalyzed the samples because I think a lot of people are concerned about how does a beer age and how do the IBUs change over time. And pretty much across the board there on that August 25th show, all those beers, regardless to where they started with the IBUs, dropped about 10 IBUs over the course of about a two-month period.
Yeah, the results from that early experiment were so shocking that it elicited some reaction from us and from the listeners. You know, number one, does your equipment work? Number two, are you doing it right? And so there was some doubt and some surprise that no matter how many hops you cram into a wort at the 60-minute addition, you had trouble getting much over 50 IBUs. That was just a shocker.
Yeah, well, and I appreciate the challenging comments that some of your listeners provided. And again, that's what this debate's all about, is to have open conversation back and forth. And, you know, one of the things that I'm reminded of is that when somebody's starting off homebrewing, you know, you pretty much tell them, you know what, sanitation's your big key, but brewing in general is pretty forgiving. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't necessarily say that with the science end of things, although there are some things that are kind of forgiving. And again, you know, my background in the chemistry allows me to know where I can take some slight variations, like, for instance, shaking by hand opposed to a mechanical shaker. There's other things that I also did during that time that I didn't really talk about the types of containers you use, whether they're plastic or glass. And again, as long as you sort of are keeping aware and keeping your basic chemistry principles in hand, I'm open to all the criticism and all the questions related to the testing of these beers. So,
And you've since found a paper that kind of backs up what you found.
Yeah, well, this is from the Journal of Agricultural Food Chemistry, a publication of the American Chemical Society. You know, these sorts of lab experiments that they talk about are very different from the experiences we have in our driveways. but they've been able to essentially start with enough alpha acids to produce a beer that would be, say, 80 IBUs. And under a variety of different conditions, they never show more than 50 IBUs in the final product. So there's something magical, I think, about that 50 IBU limit when it comes to doing a 60-minute addition.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm curious to know whether those IBUs deteriorate, or those isomerized alpha acids deteriorate over 60 minutes. And, there's some questions that we don't have an answer for, and that would be interesting to explore further.
Yeah, well, there are certainly a lot of sort of thermal breakdown products, and you know, those may have a sensory component to them as well. So again, as you know, our own particular style of brewing, whether we're doing a 90-minute, depending on if you're using a hot flame, the rate at which you're boiling, it may not just be sort of a caramelization of the sugars, but I think there could be some other thermal breakdown that adds to sort of the complexity of the final beer.
Okay. So there's our background. So I got an email from Kim in Norway saying that he had done a crazy experiment with a very hoppy beer and asked me if I would like to taste it and if I would mind forwarding some bottles on to Brad. And, of course, my answer was, heck yeah. So, Kim, tell us about the beer that you brewed.
I was visiting a friend of mine at Lervig Brewery in Stavanger and helping him out brewing a pale ale. And to help me, he reached into the hop freezer and got me a kilo of Nelson Sauvin hops. And he just said, I think he was joking at the minute, said, put them all in one brew. And I was like, well, that sounds like a stupid idea, so I'll do it. Then I went online trying to figure out if you could oversaturate with hops, use too much hops and it wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't, well, use the whole acids from them. But I couldn't really find anything on it, so I just figured out I'll try it out and see what happens. So I'm... Well, I made a pretty standard IPA, 5 gallons of it, and I put 900 grams of Nelson hops in 5 minutes before flame out, and I dry hopped with 100 grams, and, well, it was really hoppy.
So to give you some perspective, for those of us who are not metrically inclined, 900 grams of Nelson Sauvin hops equals 32 ounces or 1.98 pounds of hops. and these were the only hops in the boil, right? 5 minutes before the end?
Yeah.
So almost 2 pounds added in a 5 gallon or 20 liter batch, 5 minutes before the end of the 60 minute boil. And then that wasn't enough. You added 100 grams or 3.5 ounces as a dry hop. So, I mean, first of all, you named the beer Full Nelson, which I think is an awesome an awesome name. But tell us about what the experience of, and I assume these were pellet hops. Tell us about the experience of adding that much hop material in that volume of wort.
I didn't really know what to expect. I weighed up the hops, and it was a big heap. And I've seen videos online of people getting extreme boilovers when dumping the hops in. So I was ready with my spray bottle and everything just to spray it down. But I took the hops right out of the freezer a couple of minutes before. So the cold from the hops made the boil stop. So it was a thick green porridge on top, so I had to almost splash it down to get the hops to mix with the wort. And I can't really say if I got the boil going again in those 5 minutes, but so it was a strange experience. The whole wort was green. It looked like marsh water.
Disgusting. So adding 2 pounds of hops is an alternative chilling method.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an expensive one if you don't know a professional brewer. So when you did chill, I would imagine that the amount of hop debris at the bottom of the kettle was tremendous.
Yeah, I lost about a third. I tried to get as clear bare wort as possible over to the fermenter, so I left behind roughly a third of it. And I had to skim the Kreuzen while fermenting a couple of times because I knocked up so much hop debris It was green on top while it fermenting. It was really nasty. And my whole, I was fermenting it in my, the whole floor where I was fermenting it smelled of grapefruit. Mm-hmm. I was fermenting it inside a fridge, so kind of smelled like an IPA in my upstairs. It was nice.
Yeah, I was going to say, there are worse things.
Yeah.
and this is, a fairly moderate gravity beer, 7% alcohol by volume.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a lot of hops in a relatively modest gravity pale ale. But it fermented okay. All that bitterness and alpha acids didn't kill the or impede the yeast at all.
No, it fermented fairly clean. Fermented it with White Labs 001 California ale yeast at I think it was 16 degrees Celsius. So kind of cool. It fermented very good. Yeah.
Hey, I've got a question for you, Kim.
Yep.
When how long do you think it was that the hops were in contact with a hot wort? I mean, you have a wort chiller, or did you let it sit? Did you put it in snow? Sorry, I don't know.
I just changed my wort chiller, but at the time I was using my old one, so I think I chilled for about, I would say, 35 minutes. So it was a long chill. So I got a lot of contact time with the wort.
Okay.
Mm.
Well, you were kind enough to send 4 bottles over here to Arkansas, and I kept 2 and sent 2 up to Brad. And on the day that I got the bottles, I chilled them down, or my 2, and I shared 1 with Steve Wilkes, who was here for a video shoot at the time. And here's what we thought at the time.
I'm scared. I just want to go on record as saying I'm frightened.
So we are drinking this today because I got this in the mail today. Mm-hmm. And Kim said, test it, you know, taste it fresh because the hops are fading even as we speak.
Right.
So all the way from Norway. And man, what a wonderful thing.
Yeah, this is really, I mean, I say I'm scared jokingly. I'm really excited about trying this.
It probably hasn't had an opportunity to settle completely.
It's smoking. Wow, this is the most imperial IPA I've ever ever been within a mile of.
Well, I'm not sure what the gravity is, but the hops got to be. Let's make sure we're all. Ooh,
all even Steven here.
The head looks great, of course.
Yep.
With all, it should have awesome head retention with all those hops in there. Man, it looks, it's cloudy, but it's been in shipments. So cheers.
Ooh.
Oh my.
I haven't tasted yet because the fragrance is amazing.
Oh, that smells good. Boy, there's lots of grapefruit.
It's a little like sticking your nose, you know, when you open the hop jar, you know? I mean, it's that fresh.
Mm. Man, it's like you sliced open a grapefruit and you're smelling the face of the. It's as if you had lunch with Jimmy Cagney. Wasn't it Jimmy Cagney that did the grapefruit in the face thing?
I don't know.
He hit the woman in the face with a grapefruit.
I thought you would have known that.
I'm
not a Jimmy Cagney aficionado.
Mm. It smells awesome.
It smells wonderful.
Oh, my.
That's really good. Oh, geez. I don't know what I was expecting.
Well, you're probably expecting the bitterness to knock your head off.
Yeah, a little bit. I was just expecting to go into a pucker hemorrhage, but you don't want to do that.
I've got their first album.
Pucker hemorrhage. Actually, he was a country and western star.
I saw him on Hee Haw.
That's right.
Right after Porter Wagoner. Oh, my goodness. Wow. I mean, that's a grapefruit juice beer.
Yeah, it is.
It's like Fresca, only a beer.
It's not that bitter.
No, it's not. It doesn't blow your head
2 pounds of hops.
During the last 5 minutes.
That's
right. But still, right. You've got to extract some bitterness out of all that. Wow.
Boy, I'm impressed. That's It actually reminds me quite a bit of Maharaja. Does it you?
Yeah, it's got that. It's not as big a beer, I don't think, as Maharaja, but it is. It is nice and look at that. The back of the bottle. Alcohol by volume 7%. So it's not nearly as big as Maharaja.
No.
But man, that's that's really good.
This is easier drinking than I expected.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I could drink this all day.
Mm-hmm. Are you sure you want to send those other two beers to Brad?
No. I wish I had tasted this before I had boxed them up. I'm going to send them off tomorrow. I wish I had. Oh, man. Well, the other one.
That's delightful.
The other one I'm going to have to share with Andy, of course.
Yeah.
But, man, cheers to Kim. So we thought it was massively grapefruity. And a couple weeks after that, I took the other bottle down to Andy Sparks' homebrew shop, thehomebrewery.com. And there were happened to be a group of homebrewers, members of the Fayetteville Lovers of Pure Suds down there. And so I shared this other 12-ounce bottle with them, and we just got little samples. But they were all very impressed. I mean, the whole concept of the thing was intriguing to them, and they were very impressed that the beer was so delicious. And they were talking about grapefruit. They were talking about mango and tropical fruits and, you know, just it was incredibly fruity. And we were just shocked that this wasn't just the bitterest beer that we'd ever tasted in our lives. So were those your perceptions as well, Kim?
Yeah, actually, I was kind of thinking it would be super bitter. From all the hops, but I think it was really fruity, aromatic. So, well, I kind of shocked myself.
Like I say, it's an expensive beer, but man, it sure was tasty.
Yeah, I did test it right after the fermenter, the first one, and then it was a grapefruity punch to the face. I almost got didn't have to brush my teeth that day because it, really destroyed me. It was super hoppy. I was puckering up like, it was amazing, wild. But that that was going on for about 10 days and then it mellowed out to somewhat like what you guys tasted.
Wow. So it's incredible that it was even more pungent or more, it wasn't really pungent it was just really, really fruity when we had it. So Brad, I sent you a couple of bottles and first, before you get into the testing part, what were your perceptions on the tasting part?
I think as we've spoke before, I tend to put on separate hats. So when I'm thinking about testing a beer, I don't think that much about tasting it. I did, of course, taste it, but I'm sort of in this sort of lab mode, and I'm not really technically supposed to drink in the lab, let alone drink beer in the lab. I mean, it's sort of a double whammy for me. So I do remember a lot of the characteristics you guys are talking about. And, you know, one of the things I usually think about when I do tasting is, you know, things like the bitterness, the flavor, and the aroma. And so, I mean, it sounds like some of the perceptions we hear are in the flavor and of certainly the aroma, and that the bitters are kind of covered up.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what my role is, to really tell you what the IBUs are, because as we all know, you can hide a pretty bitter beer behind a lot of flavor. You know, some sort of bigger beers, a lot of times you lose that bitterness and exchange it for a lot of flavor, aroma, and things like that.
Okay, so you've pleaded the fifth on the tasting part. talk to us about how you did the testing part. What was your testing regime, and what did you find out?
Okay, well, let me officially apologize to Kim and to you, James, in that I was pretty slow to getting to these beers. But when I did, I'm pretty happy with the way the whole method worked out, the results worked out. You know, one of the things we talk about when you have such a beer like this, there's oftentimes sediment on the bottom of the bottle. So in our previous conversations, we talked about things like, do alpha acids stick to the side of the bottle? Do they settle out? Can you filter them out? All sorts of things like that. So what I did was I kind of considered this bottle to have three different portions. So when I carefully opened the cool bottle, I took the top one-third of the beer, and then I poured a second one-third. I rocked the bottle back up, swirled it, got all the sediment from the bottom, and poured a third one-third of the bottle. Then I set the bottle to the side, and what I did with the bottle after it was essentially, I swirled it and dumped it into that third one-third portion, I treated the bottle as if there would be IBUs stuck on the sides of the bottle. So I essentially added in 10 milliliters of water to simulate 10 milliliters of beer. And then I carried out the analysis while that sample was in the bottle. So essentially anything that stuck to the glass would have been removed in that fourth sample.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that first sample, when I carried out the Beer 23A analysis that I've done, the American Society of Brewing Chemists, I got a measurement of 86 IBUs. So indeed, it was a hoppy beer.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, thinking about the second one-third pour, again, I didn't rock it back or anything like that. I didn't disturb the sediment on the bottom. I managed to get a 90 IBUs. That measurement of 90 versus 86 is probably within the air of doing the analysis. In reality, what I probably should have done is had three separate beers, did it in triplicate. But again, you know, it's all in the spirit of homebrew, I guess. I don't know. I guess, you know, each sample takes about maybe 30 minutes to do the analysis. So again, you know, we're talking whenever you do things in triplicate, as I did with some of the other programs, you know, that requires a little bit more product. So now the third pour, which would be the last third of the bottle, which I then did rock it back up, swirled it around, and then poured it out. When I did the IBU test on that, I came up with 131 IBUs.
Wow.
So now that had substantial amount of hop material and other trub and other sorts of things in the bottom of the bottle. This is probably not a bad time to remind you that the Beer 23A assay will extract both alpha and beta acids. And so it's likely that, you know, there's some beta acids that are in here. Actually, it sort of sees the alphas, the betas, and the iso-alphas all as the same thing. You hope that you're somewhat selective of it when you have the final product as a beer and that you've boiled off all your betas. But in reality, in this case, there's probably still a fair amount of hop oils and other sorts of stuff that might have been left over in that trub.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fourth sample, I'll just get it all out here, is essentially the sample or the bottle that if there was something left in the bottle. Now, let me remind you, I did not rinse it with water. So there was this trub that was mixed up in there. And then I poured back in the 10 mLs to simulate the beer in there. It came up with an IBU measurement of about 10. So was that stuck to the glass? I don't know. Was it left over? Well, I guess, again, you could do these experiments in different ways, and I could have rinsed the bottle with water, but then that would have maybe potentially washed off some of the IBUs. So I figured this was the best go-around.
Right. So that's some pretty interesting results. That there being that much IBU material down at the bottom, might this might this kind of explain why hoppy beers seem to fade over time, is that this stuff is settling out?
Yeah, that would be a good thought there. I mean, you know, these hop materials and these oils may actually become suspended in a beer. You know, just like your milk is homogenized and you get fat to stay in liquid for a certain period of time, I wouldn't be surprised that there's some, you know, plant materials that could assist in homogenizing some of these oils and might, you know, you do the analysis on that. When you pour that out, you've got these oils suspended in the solution. As you let it sit over time, yeah, things certainly fall out, and there's certainly more hops down there in the bottom than there were on the top.
Now, if I understand you correctly, this test that you did, it not only measures the components that lend to the bitterness of the beer, the isomerized alpha acids, but it would also see hop oils and materials that are not isomerized and could be, you know, kind of leftover material from the hops, as like from the dry hopping and from the material at the very end of the boil that might not have been exposed to the heat long enough to isomerize them?
Yeah, well, and it really comes down to, you know, solubility and whether things are actually dissolved in that beer. The assay that is prescribed by the American Society of Brewing Chemists is one that looks for, you know, a certain type of molecular structure. And that molecular structure is very similar between a number of different compounds. So in some scenarios, it's not the most exact assay for doing IBUs. But let's just keep in mind that when a brewery publishes an IBU, they're using, well, oftentimes they don't say how they calculated that. They might have just used sort of one of the Tinseth or the Rager calculation based on what they put in. Mm. If they have an analytical lab, then they might have done the Beer 23A assay. And if that's the case, you know, they're reporting the value based on that assay. There's enough wonderful information on six-pack holders that I don't recommend necessarily answering or putting that on the box. Although, of course, I would like to know how they determine that value. So.
Now, Kim, what did you think when you saw these results?
Well, I was kind of blown away about the last pour, that the IBUs were settling in the bottom, because we've been talking about where the hops go when the beer ages. And that was, well, a nugget of gold right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to get the IBU reading of the beer. I didn't believe it was that high, actually. So, yeah.
Did you
thanks to Brad.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much to Brad, and thanks to you, Kim, both, while we're thanking people for... But did you happen to do a calculation with a bitterness formula or a bitterness calculator?
Beforehand?
Yes.
Yeah, I used the Bearsmith 2, and I got calculation of about... I think it was 72 with the Tinseth formula.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So Brad, I guess we confirmed that your technique and your instruments are able to read above 50 IBUs.
Yeah, that's very good news. Yeah. That did bother me a little bit. And actually, I even talked to on email, talked to Bamford out at UC Davis, my graduate school, where I went to graduate school in the chemistry department. I didn't know about the beer at the time, but he was actually traveling in Europe and was not able to answer my questions. But I did talk with one of his lab techs about their method of doing things. So again, nice collaboration environment that happens.
So. We were talking before I hit record that this has your earlier experiment as compared to this experiment has some implications for home brewers. I mean, if you are pumping a ton of hops into the beginning of a 60-minute boil, thinking that you're going to get, you know, 70, 80 IBUs just from that, you may be barking up the wrong tree and you may be wasting a lot of hop material.
Yeah, I think that is probably the take-home here. I mean, you know, there's a certain stability associated with these types of material. And, you know, when we're boiling them, we're being, you know, it's a pretty aggressive environment. So you certainly carry out the isomerization reaction, but you also tend to break down things, break down those iso-alpha acids into other products. Whether those other products have a positive or negative sensory aspect, I don't know, but we certainly have a lot of experiments to do. But like you said, the recommendation I think we're going to put forward, if I can make that, is that, you know, calculate 50 IBUs with your 60-minute addition, and if anything more, anything more that you put in there is essentially wasting that hop material.
Mm-hmm.
And what you want to do is just save that for a late addition. You know, and again, in the case here with Kim's beer, you know, when you're doing a cool down time, you know, that standard wort chiller is going to get that cool down and, you know, 15 to 30 to 45 minutes even, you know, there's still some isomerization that's occurring. So when you use a calculator and you put in something like, you know, I put in 14 pounds, was it, Kim? I forget. Something like that. when you put that in at, you know, at 5 minutes, you know, you calculate it for an isomerization taking place during 5 minutes, but in reality, it's a much more complicated process because, I mean, you get isomerization at 90 and at 80 and at 70. It's just not the same percentage you get when you're at boiling. So put in enough. You want to get 100 IBU beer, get enough hops at T60 to bring you to 50, and then add the rest of it to bring you up to your 100 mark.
Yeah. Now this, I mean, this reinforces my my position that we need a real, accurate hop bitterness calculation formula. I mean, right now we're chipping away at the present ones, and you know this is another chip at those formulas, and that I don't know that any of them take this into account. So. Somebody ought to sit down and do some real laboratory experiments and design a formula that actually will give you reliable results, as opposed to and I've talked to really good brewers who say I looked at this recipe on the Beersmith or on the brewer's application there, and it didn't fit into the style guidelines, so I switched from from Tensis to Daniels, and it fit.
Yeah.
on the bitterness formula. So, you know, that just doesn't seem to make sense to me. It's just a moving target. So anyway, that's just my beef.
Well, and I think there's two parameters that need to be added to any calculations. One of them is the solubility. And I have some other technical papers that I haven't shared that talk about solubility. But again, these kinds of experiments are not always directed 100% towards the question that we're asking. So again, we've got some experiments to do. But solubility is an important one. And also the cooling time for the wort chilling, mm-hmm, is, I think, a pretty important part. I know that some of my previous experience with a professional brewer is that they use a whirlpool and... You know, you throw in a whirlpool, you throw in a lot of hops there sort of as a T0 addition. Well, you're going to get a lot of oils in there. And depending on how your brewing system is, whether that prevents those oils from transferring through the system or they get lopped off at some point or filtered off some point, you know, it depends a lot on the equipment that you're using. So in some ways, James, there may never be one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think solubility and wort chilling time are two things we need to take into account.
Yeah, I think the way the formulas work now, they count hops added at flame out the same as hops added as dry hopping, right? As far as the
right.
the IBU extraction.
Yep. Yeah.
So Kim, has this changed the way you look at formulating your recipes?
Yeah, definitely. When I'm making pale ales or IPAs now, I tend to move more of the IBUs towards the end of the boil to get that more aromatic bitterness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I think that's my strategy as well. I lay down a base when I'm doing an all-grain batch, a full all-grain batch. I lay down the base bitterness at 60 minutes and then just add a ton of hops at the end. But I do my 15-minute boil extract beer that, you know, all of my hops are added within 15 minutes because that's the length of the boil. And I found that that's a really good beer as well. And other people have brewed it too, and they like it too. So the same concept, you know, it's all the hops being added in the last part of the boil. So, yeah, very, very, very interesting. And I want to mention you also said, Kim, that that you've been working on a project or you had a beer that's been produced commercially?
Yeah. Well, I've co-brewed a beer with a friend of mine, Gar Smith Garsen, at Lervig for a pub in Bergen. We released Imperial Amber Ale there a couple of weeks ago. And, well, it was... It was a success, so we're making another one this fall, and we're tinkering with Full Nelson to try and make it commercial.
Oh my!
so far, we're not getting there yet, though, because it's very complex to get that hop profile in a commercial brew. So, fingers crossed, maybe we'll get something, maybe a half Nelson.
and the sequel to that would be Atomic Elbow off the Turnbuckle, as they another wrestling term. Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see how much you would have to charge per 12-ounce bottle of a Full Nelson to make it commercially viable with all those hops in there.
Yeah, especially doing it in Norway with the taxes going up the wazoo. So. Well, we'll see.
Well, good luck on that, and keep us posted. It's exciting whenever I hear, you know, of homebrewers that I've corresponded with doing some professional stuff. Very, like I say, very exciting. Is there anything else? I mean, this was, to me, this is kind of a landmark episode or a landmark experiment that I think people can really take some groundbreaking information from.
Yeah, sure. Sorry. yeah, no, I think you're right, James. I think none of us really know how to do this right, whatever right means. And I think the more we learn about it and the more we ask questions and tinker and stuff, the more we're going to find out. So I think we're right there with our the right attitude of diving in and just asking questions. We got Kim doing sort of crazy things over there and sort of pushing the limits. So I'm willing to do some analysis whenever you get the next guy to come on board, James.
Well, you've opened the door. I hope that that this will inspire other people to do some crazy things. You know, that's what homebrewing's about. It's about pushing the bounds and rewriting the rules as we go along. And you know, whenever interesting things happen like that, the science looks at it and gets to reexamine things at the same time. So. This has been a lot of fun. Kim, I appreciate very much your sending the beers over. They were delicious, as you heard. And Brad, thanks very much for taking the time out in the lab. We know it's a lot of work for you to do that. And I think we're breaking new ground here.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again very much to Kim and Brad for the inspirational beer and the informative lab work. I do think that this is important stuff. I'm very grateful that those guys included us in the process. By the way, Kim is already brainstorming another extreme brewing session, so I can't wait for that. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site, along with our Brewer's Logbook, which is now available to order. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our new Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Handwriting Without Tears, Grade 3 Cursive Handwriting. I could use that myself. And the return of the spectacular spinning songbook. You know who that is, don't you? That's Elvis Costello. We saw the spinning songbook in person up in Kansas City. Awesome show. If you get a chance to see Costello and the Imposters and the spectacular spinning songbook, go. Don't hesitate. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. And we appreciate your support greatly. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through an associate link on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.